It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the primary elections in Wisconsin are tomorrow. We'll check in on the biggest races on the ballot and the latest on endorsements and some last-minute drama. First, the United States has had more than 350 mass shootings this year, as defined and tracked by the Gun Violence Archive. High-profile mass shootings are leaving some people, including school children, fearful about a shooting in their own hometown or school. Our next guest is a psychologist who says there are ways to help kids and adults deal with that kind of anxiety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a problem you've run into, a concern, an anxiety you've run into with your kids? Do you wonder how to talk to them when events like mass shootings, especially ones at schools, are in the news? What are you talking about as you head into back-to-school season? Teachers, do you have this concern for yourselves, or do you run into concerns from parents or children at school? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Travis Wright is an associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, specializing in early childhood education and teaching students who have experienced trauma. Travis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this isn't just about kids, this kind of anxiety, of course. Travis, can you talk about some of the common emotions people might feel, not even talking about the people who directly experience these events, but those of us who follow them, who see them in the news?
So, you know, we're all stressed. I think that the mass shootings are happening against the broader context of stress. The political system is sort of uncertain. We are in the midst of a global pandemic with potentially another sort of pandemic on the rise. And so I think people generally are stressed. Our baseline is heightened. And so mass shootings are occurring sort of against a backdrop of stress that people are already feeling. And so I think that shootings only heighten the stress that we're already feeling and actually can be something that we can sort of become fixated or focused on because it actually feels a little more concrete than some of the other stressors that we're facing. So I think it can, you know, many of us are probably being impacted by stress in lots of different ways. We may find that we're having trouble sleeping. We may be shorter tempered. We may be having a hard time concentrating and focusing. We may find less meaning in things that used to bring us joy. We may be overeating. We may be undereating. We may have trouble sort of making plans and following through on things. So these are all signs of stress. Some people become hypervigilant, and so they can't stop thinking about it. So you may find that you have children or friends or family members who are just talking about mass shootings all the time. You may have other people who just seem more numb and they're not actually dealing with the stress that they're feeling. They sort of shut down. So stress can look very different. People experience stress very differently. They have different ways of manifesting it, but I think it's safe to assume that everyone is feeling the heat sort of increasing in the pressure cooker right now.
After a horrific event like the Uvalde shooting in Texas back at the end of the last school year, we're coming into a new school year now. What in particular can parents watch for in their kids who may not, you know, just volunteer or speak up that particular event is making them feel bad, but it might be there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think parents should be curious about any types of changes in their children's behavior, particularly trouble sleeping. Younger children may start bedwetting after having not bedwetted for a while, nightmares, kids who are having anxiety about separating from their parents. You may find that your children are having just more distress when they have to be out of your presence. They may not want to leave you to go to school or to go do other things that they used to enjoy. Kids may be engaged in repetitive play when they're really traumatized. They may be playing the same thing over and over. And so if you notice that your kids are playing games about guns, games about violence, games about shooting or being shot over and over again, and it just feels like it isn't very organized or it doesn't feel very low stress, those would be some typical signs that your children might be stressed. But I would say avoidance, lethargy, acting sort of just less interested in daily things are all other kind of signs that you might watch out for as well. Trust your gut. If you're not sure how your child is doing, just ask.
I imagine the answer to this might vary, will vary depending on the age of kids. But when there is a traumatic event in the news and you're pretty sure your kid's going to come across it one way or another, what are some strategies to open up healthier conversations with those kids?
Yes, absolutely. So research shows that kids tend to cope better when they hear about things at home rather than at school or from friends or the media themselves. And so as parents and as guardians, when we know that something has happened that our children are likely to be concerned about or likely to hear about, it's best to bring it up first so that they hear it from us rather than other sources. So the first thing we can do is just to name it and ask children if they've heard about it. The second most important thing that we should do when talking to kids about difficult topics is listen. Ask kids what they know about it, ask what's on their mind, ask how they're feeling about it. Listening helps them feel connected. It helps them feel heard. It also gives us a sense of how they're making sense of the event so that we can tailor our responses to sort of how they're processing it. Sometimes kids are worried or worry in a very different way about something than adults because it might affect them differently or they may have a different perspective on the experience. And so when we assume how the children are feeling and we start talking about how things may be for them from our own experience, sometimes we raise questions in their mind that they weren't even thinking about. So we might actually heighten their worry. And other times they just don't feel like we're really paying attention or clued into what's going on with them, that we're making it more about us than about how they're doing. So listening, I would say, is the other most important strategy.
Talking to Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, looking at how to help people, kids in particular, cope with news of bad events. Thinking in particular of school shootings as we look ahead to back to school time here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest, an experience maybe in having this kind of conversation with your kid, if you're a parent, with your classroom, if you're a teacher. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Travis, I think a tough thing to negotiate can be, you know, shootings that we see in the news. These are real and they're scary, but at the same time, even though they're in the news, we see them a lot, in the scope of things, they're pretty rare. Kids are still pretty safe at schools by and large. How do you acknowledge the one thing and that reality of mostly pretty safe places in the other?
Yes. So one thing that we can do is just to make sure that children have that information. So we should share with them that it's actually really rare, that it doesn't happen very often, that most children will never experience anything like this, and explain that the media tends to cover things that are outrageous or things that may be less common. And so even though you're hearing about it a lot, it doesn't mean that it happens a lot. I think the second thing that we can do is actually limit children's exposure to media during times of crisis and really scary things. Children do often hear more than they can process, or when they hear the same thing over and over again, it can heighten their anxiety level and also make it really hard for them to escape it so that they can begin to cope. So I think, you know, letting children know what's happening, making sure that we're having conversations with them to see how they're understanding it, giving them really good information so that we can help them contextualize the likelihood that they're going to experience the event themselves, and also limit their exposure to media are all things that we can do to help them begin to cope and feel safer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have been hearing a lot of hypotheticals and memories and what ifs, but I have a friend in Texas who picked up her 14-year-old niece from school. And of course, given that the child is 14, she has been doing active shooter drills her entire school career. So she's very accustomed to planning for this sort of thing. But as her aunt was driving her home from school, they stopped to get gas at a gas station, and they saw a man by his car carrying a big rifle. And the 14-year-old girl began shaking all over and then crying and vomiting. So I'm thinking of the visceral bodily response in children that may be in the moment, that is a little bit beyond what you're talking about, the fears and the hypotheticals, but this is, what would your guest suggest for a situation that is so very immediate and visceral?
Linda, thanks for the call. Travis, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. So in that moment, I think that it's really important to help the child feel grounded, sort of ask them to come into their breath, to sort of, you know, breathing is one of the ways that we can help regulate our body so that we start to feel control over it. What your guest, what Linda was sharing, was this really painful experience of her niece sort of having a traumatic reaction. Sort of in that moment, we were seeing her come undone in a certain way, because this fear that she had been programmed to be afraid of was suddenly potentially coming true, or certainly that fear was being triggered. And so in that moment, we basically feel unsafe. We feel threatened for our lives. And so the most important thing we can do in that moment is to, one, ensure that the person is safe, and to help them realize it. So focusing on the breathing, helping them to sort of feel their body in the car, getting them away from the situation so that they aren't in close proximity to the trigger anymore. But certainly that type of reaction points to the fact that this young woman is really struggling to feel safe. And so I would say that when we see that type of reaction, it's also important to reach out for professional help to make sure that the child has the coping skills that she needs to navigate these really scary things. You know, obviously being closer to the event in proximity. So living in Texas, knowing that these things can happen, already experiencing sort of warnings and being made aware of the danger of these types of threats for her whole life, it sort of was a recipe for this type of reaction. And so I think making sure that she gets the appropriate support to cope is really important. In that moment, I think helping her just feel safe and grounded, and helping her get to safety would be the sort of the acute response. The other thing I would say is, and Linda brought up a really good point about preparing sort of for preparing her entire lifetime for just this type of threat. You know, the research actually suggests that maybe these active shooter drills are causing far more anxiety than they may be benefiting children. And so given that, you know, some of the public health researchers now are actually questioning whether or not children should be doing these types of drills, or how often we should be doing these type of drills, because it does actually lay the foundation for just this type of fear.
Linda, thanks for that call. We're talking to Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, looking at how to manage fear and anxiety related to mass shootings, especially focusing on kids and back to school time. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you had these conversations with your own kids, your own students? Have you seen anxiety in kids you work with or kids in your lives related to these shootings? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about fear and anxiety some people may experience following a mass shooting, what can be done to help deal with that fear, especially when it comes to kids in schools. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a student worried about school shootings? How has news affected you over the years? If you're a parent or teacher, what kind of conversations do you have with kids about these things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Travis, I know a lot of your work involves kids who have trauma, whether a long-term thing in their daily lives or have experienced acute trauma, and how it affects their learning in the classroom. How can teachers help kids in those situations learn?
Yeah, absolutely. So trauma makes it very hard to learn. When we're worried for our lives, when we're scanning the environment, wondering what's going to go wrong next, it's very difficult to focus on things like math and reading and remembering sort of historical facts. So in order for kids who've experienced trauma to actively engage the curriculum and to learn, it's really important for them to feel safe and also respected. And so some things that teachers can do are making sure that there are consistent routines, making sure that there are schedules, that kids know what's going to happen, that there are clear procedures and processes in the classroom. And increasingly in my own work, I'm learning that trauma not only affects the way kids feel at school, but it actively impacts the way that they process information and learn as well. So for example, kids that are developing in the midst of challenging circumstances where scary things seem to happen out of nowhere often don't develop a sense of cause and effect. So they sort of walk through the world and things just happen. So as they're processing information, they don't necessarily connect that information to each other in a logical way. And so as teachers, it's really important to sort of point out the connections between narratives. This happened and that happened and this happened, to really point out cause and effect relationships so that kids begin to make connections between sort of what happened before and what's happening next and then what's going to happen as a consequence. That not only helps children learn better, but it also helps reinforce the idea that there is actually some logic and some reason and some predictability in the world. And I think that both helps kids learn better, but it also helps them begin to feel more regulated and safe and stable as well. When we've experienced scary things, it changes the way that we view the world. And so anything that we can do to help things feel like they make more sense helps individuals and especially children begin to heal from traumatic experiences.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Burlington. Rich, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I really appreciate your guest bringing up the fact that the active shooter drills and all that can be creating more stress. I'm a retired school teacher. I taught high school science. One of the things I taught was chemistry. And anytime we did explosions, which is really the whole point of teaching chemistry, but anytime we did explosions, we had to let everyone know that this was coming, this is going to happen. We didn't level a building or anything, but just some of the typical stuff that's done in chemistry classroom because it was stressful. I taught through the years when Columbine occurred, and it was years before we had anywhere near full attendance in our school on the anniversary date of Columbine. And I really ascribe that to much of the overhype of school shootings. And I'm not saying school shootings don't happen and they're not tragic. I absolutely believe that. But if you were to look at the total negative effect on all of the kids in the country and the stress and the suicide rate among young people is way up. The stress of the training and the active shooter drills where we had kids huddled in the corner and we're throwing desks against the doors. And we had SWAT teams walking down the hall just to simulate. And that stress, I am sure total effect had to be far in excess. And I'm not downplaying a real school shooting.
I gotcha, Rich. Thanks for the call. And Travis, that gets back to some of what you were talking about earlier, some pushback on the idea that these active shooter drills are a net plus.
That's it. I really appreciate Rich's perspective as an insider to the school experience. And I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind when we're deciding how to address issues in particular communities is that maybe a one-size-fits-all approach doesn't work. The reality is that there are different levels of risk in different communities. The type of support and the type of intervention and the level of risk in one place may be very different than the risk in another place. In communities with high rates of violence, it's important for children to know how to keep themselves safe and what the procedures are. And if they don't know that information, it feels more scary. But in contrast, in communities where the risk may be pretty low or children haven't experienced or been exposed to violence, discussions of violence can actually heighten their anxiety. And so I think when we make decisions about what's best for children, we have to remember that schools are local, that they happen in neighborhoods, that they happen in communities. And so we should be talking with kids and teachers in those communities about what they need. Far too often, we sort of politicize the school environment and we sort of make policies based on what would make us feel better or what we think should happen. But many times this isn't aligned with what kids and teachers in that particular school need. So I think really being in touch with how kids are feeling, how teachers are feeling, how families are feeling, and tailoring the sort of supports that we provide is critical.
Thanks for that call, yeah. Rich. Time for one more caller. Kathy's with us in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned that we are talking about this like it is accepted. And this is just the way it is. It's like, okay, we have one more degree of Celsius heat. So that's the way that is. We're not doing much about that either. But why aren't we talking about changing?
Kathy, we're just about out of time, but Travis, I know that's important to you. People can kind of take control in some ways by becoming active on issues. In our last few moments, can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that is most traumatizing to us is feeling powerless and out of control. And so I agree with your caller that when we accept violence as a part of life and we send our schools, children to school worrying that they're not going to be safe, that's just a recipe for feeling fearful and anxious and out of control. So one of the things that we can do as parents, as community members, as grandparents, and as students is we can speak up about the policies that we would like to change. To make our school safer, you know, meaningful gun control, for example, if that's something that your family believes would help. I think being involved at the social level and helping feel like you're having an impact on what's happening around you helps you feel more agency, which ultimately helps you feel safer in the end.
Kathy, thanks for that call. And Travis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Travis Wright, associate professor in the Department of Counseling Psychology at UW-Madison. He specializes in early childhood education and teaching students who have experienced various forms of trauma. Coming up after the news, we'll get a preview of the top races on the ballot tomorrow in Wisconsin's primary election. In-person voting is tomorrow. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a scientist joins us for a look at the origins of minerals, thousands of different kinds here on planet Earth, and what they could mean for life on other planets. Now, tomorrow is primary election day in Wisconsin. The polls are open from 7 in the morning until 8 at night. By the way, you can find out what's on the ballot and where you can vote by visiting myvote.wi.gov. The headliner in tomorrow's race is a tight Republican campaign for governor between millionaire businessman Tim Michaels, former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, and State Representative Tim Ramthan. Clayfish campaigned with former Vice President Mike Pence last week, while former President Donald Trump came to Wisconsin this weekend to hold a rally with Michaels. Trump also took aim at State Assembly Leader Robin Voss and endorsed his primary opponent. On the Democratic side, the primary for U.S. Senate cleared up a lot ahead of Election Day. The top challengers to Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes dropped out and endorsed him as the candidate to take on Senator Ron Johnson in the fall. We're checking in on the top races in the state ahead of tomorrow's Election Day, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these races in tomorrow's primary? What is on your mind if you are a Republican voter? What are you thinking about in this tightly contested race to run against Tony Evers for governor? Do the endorsements matter to you from former President Trump, from former Vice President Pence, from former governors like Scott Walker and Tommy Thompson splitting their votes on that as well? What are you looking forward to in the fall on either of these high-profile races? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's editor of the Election Law Journal and affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, the big mystery tomorrow, I think, is going to be who comes out on top on the Republican side of the race for governor. What are you seeing in this race? Kind of heated.
It is a very tight race. So we had the Marquette poll in late June that showed them within a couple points, and then this Emerson poll came out over the weekend that had Clayfish up by 2 points, which is within the margin of error. But there still was a 14% undecided in that most recent poll that was, again, over the weekend. And that's a pretty high undecided percentage for this point of a campaign. And so they're quite a few voters, I think, who are just tuning in now and trying to figure out what they're going to do in this hotly contested election.
I want to give a listen to a couple of big, high-profile, national-style politician endorsements. Former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish held a campaign event with former Governor Scott Walker, and here, former Vice President Mike Pence, who formally endorsed her in the race.
And I am confident the people of Wisconsin know that your next governor needs to be a proven conservative who has stood in the pocket for Wisconsin in the past, and that's Rebecca Clayfish.
Then this weekend, Tim Michaels held a rally with former President Trump, who endorsed him and attacked Clayfish.
Tim's opponent in the primary is Rebecca Clayfish, a career politician and a political insider. Known her for a long time. She's the handpicked candidate of the failed establishment.
Okay, two big names spending time here in Wisconsin. Do you think these endorsements matter, David?
Well, I think Trump's endorsement definitely matters. He's weighing in on a lot of primaries around the country and has had a fair amount of success in getting his endorsed candidates to win the Republican primaries. He had, some failures, especially like in Georgia and some other states. But the Emerson poll that, again, I referred to this conductor over the weekend here in Wisconsin, asked specifically about how much the Trump endorsement had an effect on their decision to support Michaels or Clayfish. Over a third of the respondents to the poll said that they were were more likely to support Michaels because of the endorsement. So 49% said it made no difference, but then 11% said they were less likely to support because of Trump, and 39% said they were more likely to support Michaels because of Trump's endorsement. Now, the other endorsements from Pence, Walker, Ted Cruz also endorsed Rebecca Clayfish, and then Tommy Thompson somewhat surprisingly endorsed Tim Michaels, I think, because Clayfish is seen as more of the establishment Republican, and Thompson certainly has traditionally been in that wing of the Republican Party. So that was the one endorsement I think that was a bit surprising.
I'm on email lists for lots of political groups in the state. There are a lot of accusations. The other side's lying. They're cheating. There's some bad blood here. But we've seen this in Republican national races before. Ted Cruz took a lot of hits from Donald Trump, ended up supporting Donald Trump. It seems like they could probably get together. Nobody's going to end up voting for Tony Evers, probably, if they're on one side of this or the other.
Yeah, there definitely will be some, I think, bruised egos and some ruffled feathers in the campaign, especially among the campaign insiders, because this has been a pretty heated battle. In contrast to the Democratic Senate primary, whereas you noticed in your lead-in piece that the field basically cleared for Mandela Barnes, and that campaign never went negative. It was really pretty remarkable for a statewide race like that, with that significant of a nomination at stake, that didn't go negative at all. But here on the Republican side for the gubernatorial primary, it really has gotten pretty dirty. But I think you're right that the party has had this tradition of pulling together, and you would imagine that the losing candidates will end up endorsing the victor on Tuesday, and they'll focus on trying to beat Governor Evers in the fall.
Talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison and the Elections Research Center there, looking at tomorrow's primary day elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. Just want to make a quick comment here. As a generally conservative voter, I'm definitely underwhelmed with Clayfish. There's something just about her feels kind of fake or just very, very shallow. I've been around her before in previous engagements. And similarly, I think Michaels just hasn't divested his business life enough to my own interests of even considering him as a viable candidate. And to be honest, I think our current governor has done a pretty good job overall during his tenure as governor. There are a few things I'd like to see him focus on with the Department of Natural Resources and some of the surplus money we have as a state. But overall, I'm actually going to be making the switch this time and staying Team Evers. So just wanted to throw that out there. Thanks,
Jake,
for having me.
Thanks for the call. Jake identifying as a Republican, saying he'll vote for Governor Evers, approves of him. People like that exist when we look at the polling, but I think Jake would be fairly rare in Wisconsin. David, I don't know.
No, I think you're right, Rob, that if you look at polling in Wisconsin, voters really are pretty locked in their partisan lanes right now. And that we've seen that in the last couple of election cycles where you don't have as much crossover voting as we had seen, say, 10 years ago in Wisconsin. And this is true nationally with the parties being more polarized than they've been before. And the extent of, you know, split ticket voting where you'll vote, you know, say, you know, for the Republican in the general election for the Senate, and then you vote for the Democrat, you know, for the governor in the general election, you just hardly see that anymore, whereas that was fairly common even 10, 15 years ago.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Liz joins us now in Eau Claire. Liz, hi.
Hi there. What am I supposed to do with my radio?
I can't hear it, so go for it.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm calling about the 3rd Congressional District in Southwest Wisconsin, currently held by Ron Kind, who is retiring. This is pretty heavily contested with 4 applicants, candidates. And frankly, the Democratic Party in this area was really disappointed when Representative Kind, who I respect totally, endorsed one of the candidates, and our state constitution very clearly says that we don't endorse prior to the primary, and this is to give everybody who wants to be a candidate an equal chance. A little bit disappointed in him.
Liz, thanks for the call. Liz, set it up nicely there for Democrats running to replace Ron Kind, a Republican, Derek Van Orden, already pretty much locked in, Republicans hoping to flip that seat currently held by a Democrat. Liz, disappointed. I hadn't seen the news that Congressman Kind had endorsed one of the candidates running to replace him. Your thoughts on that race, David?
Yeah, it definitely is the most contested of our 8 congressional districts here in Wisconsin. The others are not seen as being really up for grabs, but that one definitely is, because it is a very split district in terms of its partisan leanings, a very competitive district. And Ron Kind was able to hang on to that district by being a very moderate Democrat. But that it's a part of the state that could easily flip to the Republicans in a year that nationally is supposed to be favorable to Republicans, especially given concerns about inflation and the other, you know, issues that Republicans are trying to push in the midterm elections. Now, on the other hand, the kind of wild card here, I think, in Wisconsin is how people respond to the overturning of the Roe v. Wade decision. And especially we have, you know, on the books the pre-Civil War law, you know, concerning abortion. And that's, you know, become an issue in quite a few races. We've seen it brought up in both the gubernatorial and senatorial primaries and some of the House primaries as well, and in state legislative races. So that is kind of the wild card here in terms of how much that could affect turnout in the fall. Now, for the primary, there's no difference between the 4 Democratic candidates in the 3rd congressional district on that. They're all pro-choice. And so that won't, I think, have a big impact on that primary election, but that could be something we'll keep an eye on in the fall.
Thanks for that call, Liz. We are previewing tomorrow's primary elections in Wisconsin with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the divides in the Republican primary for governor? How about the Democratic race for Senate? Do you wish more leading candidates had stayed in to make it more of a contest? What about efforts to unseat Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, by fellow Republicans, including former President Trump? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison political science professor David Cannon, previewing the top races in Wisconsin's primary elections tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're voting in the Republican primary for governor, who has your vote and why? Or is it still a coin toss for you? Trump endorsement, Pence endorsement, do they matter? If you're on the Democratic side of things, how do you feel about the other candidates lining up behind, most of the other candidates lining up behind Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes for U.S. Senate? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, David, this development just over the last week or so, an attempt to unseat Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in a primary campaign. His challenger got an endorsement from President Trump. Michael Gabelman, the former state Supreme Court justice who Robin Voss hired to investigate the outcome of the 2020 elections, turning against his employer, basically endorsing the primary challenger. What's going on?
Yeah, that's a very unexpected turn of events for sure. I mean, that I don't think anyone saw that coming, to have, you know, both President Trump weigh in, you know, in a state legislative race, and then have Gabelman actually, you know, run an ad against Robin Voss. Yeah, it's really a very remarkable turn of events. Now, it seems to me that, you know, Voss is secure enough in his district that I would be really surprised if he would end up being unseated. But who knows? And, you know, crazier things have happened, that's for sure.
And the issue of November 2020 and the elections there, still a big part of this race now being talked about, election integrity. One candidate for Governor Tim Ranthan still saying, hey, we need to overturn the outcome of the presidential election in Wisconsin, which you can't do. How is that a worry for Republicans? Do you think that that's going to loom over a general campaign after the primaries are done?
Well, right. I think this is something that, you know, Democrats are hoping they'll be able to use against some of the more extreme Republicans who end up getting nominated, and talk about decertifying the election. See the same thing in the attorney general's race on the Republican side. I think at least one and maybe two of the candidates there for attorney general in the primary have also called for decertifying the result of the election, which, again, you cannot do that. And so I think this is something that Republicans, some Republicans are worried about, that if, you know, you have nominees who are staking out a position that's so clearly on the extremes, that could harm their chances of winning in the fall.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hello.
Hi. I am a Democrat, and I don't see the reason that I should waste my vote in the Democratic primary. Wisconsin has a rich tradition of crossover, but I don't hear anything about that, and I'm wondering why I shouldn't vote in the Republican primary. And I'll get off the air to listen.
All right, Jack, thanks for the call. Jack does not have a heavily contested, say, congressional primary going on if he's voting in Milwaukee. So, I don't know, Democrats. But on the other hand, if Democrats wanted to be strategic in the governor's race, who knows what that would mean?
Well, right. And this is really interesting. Actually, I've talked to some people just in the last few days who are going to do exactly the same thing that Jack's doing. And Democrats were going to vote in the Republican primary. But I hear two different theories. You have some people are doing what the Democratic Governors Association did in several high-profile races, like the Maryland governor's race, where they actually spent money on behalf of the Trump-endorsed candidate, thinking that would get the weaker nominee on the ticket that they could then beat in November, which is exactly what happened. And they did this in Arizona, some other states as well, where Democrats are like openly backing and telling Democrats to vote in the Republican primary to elect the Trump-endorsed candidate, thinking that gives them a better chance of winning the general election. But then I hear some other Democrats who are saying they're going to do this strategic voting in the primary and vote for Clayfish, thinking that, you know, if and thinking that Evers has, you know, might lose, and they want to have a candidate they think would be, you know, better than Michaels from a Democratic voter's perspective. So, yeah, it could cut both ways. And I haven't seen any polling to indicate this is going to be a large percentage of the electorate. But you got to believe there's going to be at least a few percentage, maybe up to 5% of Democrats who will end up doing that. And we'll have to see if that ends up playing a role in the outcome of this election or not.
Thanks for that call. Melanie joins us now in Adams. Melanie, hello.
Hi. I'm calling because I was trying to voice my opinion. When it comes to Clayfish, I think she's just been in politics too long. Some things got kind of fishy with her husband. I've emailed her, talked to her about things. I am pro-life. I'm a chair for the right to life for my county. And we would really like to see a heartbeat bill passed in Wisconsin. And when I asked her about that, she really didn't have a straight answer if she would support something like that. I think Michaels is more straightforward. He tells it how it is. And when it comes to Van Orden, Derek Van Orden, I'm definitely voting for him. He also agrees with term limits in Congress, which, I mean, let's be honest. We got some of these guys in there that are near 90 years old that have done nothing but politics and worked in government all their life and never had a real job like the average Joe.
Melanie, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. David, one selling point for Melanie for Michaels is, and this is his campaign is doing this, I think former President Trump did this, outsider candidate, not a lot of time spent in politics.
Right. Now, it is something that has resonated with Wisconsin voters in the past. If you look at our track record of electing people to very high office who don't have previous experience. So Herb Kohl, for 18 years in the Senate. Now Ron Johnson, also one of our current incumbent senators who had no prior political experience before being in the Senate. So I think we do tend to have at least some favor that we give to people that don't have political experience sometimes, especially in times like this where I think people are kind of fed up with the status quo. It ends up being a way of kind of a protest vote against the system. And so I think there are quite a few voters like Melanie who really are supporting Michaels because he's not a politician.
Thanks for that call, Melanie, at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison, previewing tomorrow's primary elections in Wisconsin. Back to your calls. Mark is with us in Mineral Point. Mark, hello.
Yeah, hello. So I did not cross over into the Republican primary list, although it's disappointing that the Republicans haven't put up anybody or nobody stepped forward to oppose Ron Johnson, especially considering that he's now admitted that he's going to push to cut Social Security. He didn't frame it exactly that way, but we know from his past record that that's what he wants to do, not to mention his support for overturning the election and other completely extreme positions. So I guess the Republicans are happy with Ron Johnson, but I think he's going to lose to Mandela Barnes.
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark, David referring to Senator Johnson in an interview saying not that he wanted to cut Social Security, but he wanted to take it off of the mandatory funding and put it up for kind of congressional negotiation each year to be renewed. And that, I think, will be the subject of many a campaign ad from his opponents.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that's something, Social Security is often referred to as the third rail of politics. Like, you touch it and you die. And so, you really don't want to mess with Social Security. And so it really is kind of a head-scratcher why he would bring that up at this stage of the campaign. But Mark makes a good point just generally about Ron Johnson, that nationally he is seen as the most vulnerable Republican incumbent that's up for re-election this year. And so one thing we'll definitely see in this election is a huge amount of outside money coming in, both in support of Johnson on the Republican side because they know he's vulnerable, but also on the Democratic side being opposed to Ron Johnson. So this will be a very high-profile Senate race nationally.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. David, let's wrap up by looking ahead to November. Now, it seems like probably Lieutenant Governor Barnes will be the one challenging Senator Johnson. TBD, certainly on the Republican side, challenging Governor Evers. What are the big themes you're going to be watching for as we come out of tomorrow's primary?
Well, one thing is clearly the state of the economy and whether inflation gets under control. I mean, I think those are the big things right now the Republicans are really pushing. Yeah, we had those back-to-back quarters that had the drop in GDP. That's the technical definition of a recession. But then we had this really strong jobs report that shows unemployment still at a 50-year low and creating over 500,000 jobs in the last month. And so the economy seems to be really robust by that measure. And so which direction the economy goes, I think, will have a big impact on how big the losses are for the Democrats in November. Because in these midterm years, the president's party always takes a hit. The question is, how big is that hit going to be? And I think, here in Wisconsin, our races are both going to be very, very tight, that all the polling, shows them within the margin of error at this point. With Evers, whether it's Michaels or Clayfish, both those are within the margin of error. With Ron Johnson, Barnes is like up, 2 points in some of the polls I've seen, but also within the margin of error. So these will be very, very close elections.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's editor of the Election Law Journal and affiliated with the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. He joined us today for a final check-in on the races in tomorrow's primary elections here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, there's a lot of road work going on around the state. Check out the construction and maintenance projects, big and small, and share your questions with the head of the state's transportation department. And you can maybe let him know where you see more work needing to be done. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. State Fair is in session now, and that means State Fair food, and that means cream puffs. So our colleagues at the Wisconsin Project have reopened the low-intensity debate about the best Wisconsin pastry, cream puff versus Kringle. They invited you to weigh in on the Ideas Network Facebook page and the Wisconsin Public Radio Facebook page. Here are some of your choices. David says, I have room for both in my life. Jeff says, Kringle. Not even close. Ellen says eclairs are better than both cream puffs and Kringle. Ellen says, I will say at least Kringle has some flavor. Wow. Liz goes with Kringle. Different Liz says Kringle for sure. But Lynn says hashtag team puff. And Steven says the correct answer is always both if you can. Same. Give me one of each. I will eat both of them. Tasty treat news you can use. This is Central Time.